From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Ahead of the Sierra Club's Big Sugar Summit later this month in West Palm Beach, we'll take a closer look at the history and growth of Florida's sugar industry, Big Sugar's political influence, and its impact on the health of the Everglades through nutrient-laden runoff, the burning of cane fields, and competing demands for water. Plus, addressing issues related to chronic homelessness are essential, but can be difficult and politically complex. We head to Sarasota, where some emergency shelters and other assistance programs for homeless families have recently been established. Meanwhile, City of Sarasota officials have adopted their own 8-point plan to address homelessness, which includes more temporary and long-term housing. We'll get an update on efforts to address homelessness in Sarasota. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. In the city and county of Sarasota, public officials and law enforcement agencies have been working to tackle the difficult and politically complex problems associated with addressing chronic homelessness. In recent months, emergency shelters for homeless families, along with other assistance programs, have been established in parts of the county. Meanwhile, city officials recently adopted their own 8-point plan for addressing homelessness, which include more transitional and long-term housing, mental health services, and the hiring of a new coordinator for the city's homelessness efforts. We'll take a closer look later this hour. But first, the Sierra Club holds a summit on Big Sugar June 20th in West Palm Beach. The day-long event brings together a variety of experts for a closer look at the history and growth of Florida's $500 million a year sugar industry, the industry's political influence, and its impacts on the health of the Everglades and on human health. Joining me now for a closer look is Frank Jackalone. He's Senior Organizing Manager for the Sierra Club and moderator of the June 20th Summit. Frank Jackalone, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Glad to be here.
We're also speaking with David Guest. He's Managing Attorney for the Florida Office of Earth Justice and a summit and featured panelists for the summit. David Guest, good to speak with you again.
Well, thank you.
Also on the line is Darren Bast. He's a research fellow in agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation's Institute for Economic Freedom and Opportunity. He's also an attorney and serves on the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Executive Committee. The focus of his studies and writings include agriculture subsidies, property rights, and environmental policy, to name a few. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
That's great to be here. Thanks.
Florida International University Geography Professor Dr. Gail Hollander joins us. She'll be speaking at the summit as well. She's authored the book Raising Cane in the Glades, The Global Sugar Trade and the Transformation of Florida. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, John, and thank you for organizing this.
And we're also speaking with Tom Lodge. He's a nationally recognized ecologist specializing in wetlands with Thomas E. Lodge Ecological Advisors, Incorporated. He's also author of the Everglades Handbook, Understanding the Ecosystem, now in its third edition, I believe. Dr. Lodge, thanks for your time today as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation. You can connect with our guests by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Frank, let's begin with you. What was the impetus behind holding this summit on Big Sugar in Florida now? Was the timing somewhat strategic in terms of potential opportunities for the state to purchase U.S. sugar land south of Lake Okeechobee for Everglades restoration, given that there doesn't seem to be much in the way of political will for moving forward with that before the offer expires in October?
John, we decided to organize this conference a year ago.
Okay.
And the reason is because we were looking at the total picture of what sugar has done to Florida society. Sugar influences our state elections. They have tremendous influence over the federal government. The latest problem that we observed was that the sugar industry burns openly their stalks in the field and releasing a lot of air pollution into the sky that people then later breathe The dust and the ash falls on their homes and property, and we were getting a lot of complaints about that. So we said, let's put it all together into one conference and bring the top experts in to talk about different aspects of sugar's influence on our society and our environment.
And Frank, despite the large size of the sugar industry's operations in South Florida, it's somewhat isolated. It's really easy for visitors and even longtime residents to go about their business in South Florida and never even see a cane field. Given that, is there a kind of a public information and outreach component to this summit as well?
Well, people, sugar certainly reaching out to all of us because we have it in our coffee, in our tea, and in the food that we eat every day. But in terms of really seeing how sugar is harvested and its impact on society, yeah, there's a lot of misinformation out there or lack of information. And so it's really time to pull back that curtain on the sugar industry, and that's what we hope to do.
Well, let's kind of go back to the beginning then. Gail Hollander, let's bring you into the conversation. I mentioned earlier you wrote a book kind of really looking into the growth of sugar in Florida. From my understanding, it really kind of got started back in the 1930s with a lot more expansion in the 50s and 60s?
That's correct. And, of course, there was interest dating back to when Florida first became a territory of the United States. And people began talking about draining the Everglades for sugar at that time because they wanted to free us from, quote, foreign sugar. So it's always had this kind of national, grasp on national politics and people's imaginations in that way. So, but it didn't get going until... as a commercial industry until the late 1920s, as you said, in part because prior to that there was so much sugar in the world and so much sugar easily purchasable on the world market. And then in addition, the United States gained territories that were sugar-producing regions or became closely linked economically with sugar-producing regions such as Cuba and Puerto Rico and so forth. So the argument for developing a domestic industry wasn't very strong, really. And so then you mentioned the 1930s, of course. That was during the Great Depression. And sugar prices were at record lows, very, very low, at the time that the industry was really trying to get going. And this is when President Roosevelt attempted to balance competing regional interests through the sugar program. And that some form of that program exists today. It's a little bit different than it was when it was established, but the program requires the Secretary of Agriculture to estimate total U.S. demand and then allocate quotas to producing regions in the United States and outside of the United States. Mm. And if you think about that, that's what made this a very, very political question, because the Florida industry and any other region would try to influence the political process to gain larger quotas.
Right. And it was South Florida in particular. Was there something about the land here that made it particularly attractive to establishing a large-scale industry? Is it, something environmental like the climate, fertile soil?
Right. So right along the south shore of Lake Okeechobee was particularly good because the lake moderates the climate. And so those are considered warmer sugar lands as opposed to farther south, which are actually not quite as... prized. But definitely the muck soils, the fact that the government stepped in to help with drainage to assure a water supply, yes, it was very, very attractive.
And of course, back at this time, nobody was thinking about you know, wetlands were wetlands. They weren't really seen as anything particularly useful. Of course, now we know a lot more about the role that they play. Tom Lodge, I wanted to bring you into the conversation now. As a nationally recognized ecologist with your focus on wetlands, what can you tell us generally about the sugar industry's long-term environmental impact?
Well, the interesting fact is the large area of what we now call the northern Everglades, that's from the south half of Lake Okeechobee on through about a third of the original Everglades system that went clear on down to the Gulf of Mexico and Florida Bay. That northern portion contained soils that were of sawgrass peat origin and modified by overflows from Lake Okeechobee. So the within the true Everglades, that was the northern piece. That's where the initial water supply from the Everglades came. And so when we, in the 1950s, started seriously then developing the ability to control the flooding of those lands, and making them available for agriculture, we just completely interrupted the original hydrologic system of Lake Okeechobee and Everglades.
Right. And a World Wildlife Report titled Sugar in the Environment found that sugar could be responsible for more biodiversity loss than any other crop due to destruction of habitat, things like heavy use of agriculture chemicals, polluted wastewater. Do you find that holds true for the Everglades?
Well, there are many species that inhabit the Everglades. It's a little bit of a misnomer to say that the actual Everglades had extremely high diversity. You look at freshwater fish, and relative to what you'd find in the southeastern United States, it's a relatively low number. But you look at the numbers of small fish that the Everglades could produce in an environment that was low nutrient, and you'd say, wow, not very productive. But there are secrets of how that happened with periphyton algae and open areas that produced a stunningly large biomass of little tiny fish that fed huge numbers of wading birds. And so while the actual diversity may not have been extremely high, the numbers supported was incredible.
Okay. And again, this, as you're saying, it kind of dates back also to agrochemicals and fertilizers that have been used and how that kind of impacts other animal and plant species as the water moves south?
Yes. The two issues. The one, the interruption of flow is critical. We're no longer getting the flows through the Everglades that we did historically because of the development of sugar land. And the way that flooding was taken care of is by routing water mainly out the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee. The St. Lucie is a completely artificial connection. The Caloosahatchee connection had been there, but it had been just a trickle of water that went that way. And so the now we essentially use that as our flood control system to take the water that initially in the 1950s and 60s when the system was young, it was clean water. We just overwhelmed those estuaries with clean fresh water that was disruptive. Now it's dirty fresh water. And the dirty water throughout the system is another huge impact flowing south into the Everglades also, where we have enrichment in phosphorus that has changed the Everglades landscape enormously, proliferation of cattails and other ramifications. And then we're also putting other chemicals in. We're putting sulfate that's used to modify pH in the Everglades agricultural area, the sugarcane area. And that gets into the Everglades and is the basis of the mercury poisoning problem. It's a rather complex set of reactions that go on, but sulfate from the north into the Everglades, from the Everglades agricultural area and other things, is stimulating that process, and at the same time then in some areas making the soils of the Everglades enriched in sulfide, the stinky component. Freshwater soils typically don't have much sulfide, but we have areas now that have enough sulfide in the water conservation area too, where we're up against the toxicity level, believe it or not, for sawgrass, which everybody says, well, that's the exemplary Everglades plant. But we have areas now that, as a result of sulfate additions, have enough sulfide in the soil to be toxic to sawgrass.
Okay. And you mentioning the cattails there kind of made me think of this, because, you know, I know that perhaps to an untrained eye, that might look like signs of just a healthy system, lots of plant life growth. But there was a recent Al Jazeera news article in which Betty Osceola of the Miccosukee tribe was quoted in regards to reality versus appearances when it comes to the Everglades' health. And she said, quote, "They all see this water, they see all this grass, and to them it looks healthy. I always tell people that Florida is the next California. California has a situation where they don't have water. Florida has a situation, they have water, but eventually you're not going to be able to drink it because it's too polluted," end quote. Is she right? Do we have a public perception problem, and are our water stores really in dire trouble here?
Do you want me to field that? I think we have some other qualified people who can get into that. But, yeah, Florida, we have a lot of water. Unfortunately, we're flat, and so we can't build a dam and store water 150 feet deep in some kind of a reservoir. We can store it a couple of feet deep, and then we have a huge, because we're warm, we have a huge evaporation problem. So discarding our water in a flood control system and not conserving it in by some means, and typically the way the landscape did it was having large acreages of shallow water. That's how we retained a water supply here. So we're in a little bit of a dangerous situation. We can't store much water, so we better figure out how to handle that situation, because we've got a lot of users.
Right, right. Well, I wanted to switch gears just a little bit here. Frank had mentioned earlier the issue of you know, burning cane fields and impacts on human health, and that's going to be one of the panel discussions at the Sierra Club Summit on June 20th. David Guest, I know that you're going to be speaking on that topic. Can you just give us a little bit of a background on when and why sugarcane growers burn their fields?
It's a practice that dates back to the 1850s. When there were snakes in the developing world, India, Australia, then they burned the foliage off, the dead leaves off, to get those down, and also to reduce the amount of weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a practice that is outdated in the developed world. Brazil has recently banned it. Australia stopped doing it 30 years ago. And the reason the sugar industry here is doing it is they simply are resistant to change. And it has a really serious effect on air pollution. That's the reason why Brazil has banned it. It's why they don't do it in Australia anymore. To give you some illustrations, the sugarcane fields, perhaps 250,000 acres, are burned every year before the harvest, and they generate something like 800 tons of hazardous air pollutants. For example, 86% of the formaldehyde in Palm Beach County comes from just those fields. Formaldehyde is the essential ingredient in embalming fluid. It has massive amounts of acetophthalene, which is a major toxic pollutant. And the Clean Air Act is designed to protect human health by controlling sources like that. It ought to be covered by the Title V Clean Air Act permit. We have recently filed comments, objections to the decision by the state of Florida not to control these pollutants. The state simply ignored that, as we expected, because of the enormous influence of the sugar industry, and we're taking that issue to the EPA now. One of the most important features of the burning problem is that, as shown by other countries, it really is unnecessary. The productivity of Australia, for example, is maybe 20%, 30% higher than it is in Florida. It used to be that in Australia that the productivity was about the same as Florida, but they made the advance and stopped burning it. They call it green cane harvesting. Until the 1990s, Florida sugar producers were so archaic in their practices that they were still using manual harvesting techniques, where they had semi-lathe labor, cutting themselves, really, really cheap labor that came from outside the United States. And only in the 1990s did they start using harvesting machines that were used in the rest of the world. The harvesting machines are designed to have a component so that they don't have to burn, so it blows the foliage off with these big fans. If you go out to the sugarcane plantation south of Lake Okeechobee, you will see that they're using the same machines they use in the rest of the world, but they've got the foliage blower fans turned off. All they have to do is turn the fans on. It doesn't impose any cost, and it increases productivity. And what we're seeing in the sugar industry is we don't care about the Clean Air Act. We think that we can get exempted and that we don't have to change our operations to modernize them because nobody can tell us what to do. Reform is needed.
David, in terms of potential impacts on human health, is this really that different from, say, what like the Florida Forest Service does in terms of prescribed burns?
Yes, it is different because the intensity of the fires, the material that they're burning, is fundamentally different. It produces a whole lot more hazardous air pollutants. For example, vast areas of Florida hundreds of thousands of acres are subject to controlled burns in many years. But just in Palm Beach County alone, just in the sugarcane fields, about 20% of all the formaldehyde in the entire state is coming up every single year. It's fundamentally different, and it's much more dangerous to people's health.
And Frank, I think you may have alluded to this earlier. Do residents who live nearby, perhaps closest to these sugar growing operations, complain about the smoke?
We think this is an environmental justice issue. If you live very close to the burning, you're going to be impacted the worst. But the people who live there are the people who are dependent on the sugar industry for their jobs and for their livelihood. And they're going to be the ones who complain the least. If you go a few miles away from the sugar burning to places like Wellington, more upscale areas that are pretty close to the burning, they are complaining about the amount of ash that's falling on their homes. So I think the people who are being hit the hardest, the ones who are living right next to the sugar burning, are the ones least able to complain about it. But we're going to uncover that in the months to come.
And I should mention, Sierra Club is actually going to be holding a press event in West Palm Beach just later this week, specifically addressing this issue.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I wanted to kind of get back into the issue of the sugar industry's political influence. And Darren Bast, you'll be speaking on the panel at the Sierra Club Summit pertaining to that specifically. When it comes to federal bipartisan support, it seems like the sugar industry does pretty well.
Yeah, thanks. They do well, and it's not unlike other agricultural interests, actually. And it's one of the problems with the farm bill. Happens you get a commodity like sugar, and they lobby on their specific area, and they winds up being kind of they get bipartisan support because ultimately what happens is there's a lot of log rolling that goes on. In other words, I'll support, your commodity in your state, and you support commodity in my state. That's kind of how it works. So the Farm Bill is kind of interesting because it's not really a partisan issue, usually. It tends to kind of cross party lines, and as a result, it's very difficult to get any type of reform. And the sugar industry is particularly influential because, kind of like other agriculture interests as well, because the government is trying to basically implement centralized planning. They are trying to determine what the market should look like, and they make it very advantageous for the sugar growers because there are limits on imports. There's limits on what kind of the amount of sugar that can be sold in the country. As a result, the objective is to try to restrict supply. And in so doing, it drives up prices for sugar. And that's obviously something that's beneficial. So when you have a specific program targeted to you and that's trying to actually control the entire market, you can see how the industry will be very vested in trying to make sure that that program remains intact. And unfortunately, it's been very difficult to get any type of reform when it comes to the sugar program.
Now, do you or the Heritage Foundation specifically take a position on this system of tariffs and quotas that, you know, limit supplies of foreign sugar and you know, drives up prices for consumers?
Yeah, so as a think tank, we don't necessarily as an organization take a
sure.
position, but you know, the analysts do, and I do, and certainly oppose the sugar program. And really, a lot of the problems that you're seeing with the sugar program, again, do exist with almost every aspect of the Farm Bill and other agricultural programs. Is what's happening is the sugar growers don't respond to the consumer needs. They simply respond to the government incentives that exist. And in many ways, if you minimize risk, it also encourages the sugar growers to basically do whatever they want to do. They don't incur the risk that they need to take. And oftentimes that may actually in many instances, lead to potentially problematic environmental practices because there's very little risk, and they may decide to use land that otherwise they wouldn't use that may, obviously, they may be environmentally sensitive, and they don't particularly care as much because the incentives encourage them not to care as much. So that's something certainly to be a concern to us, and also with not just the sugar program, as I said, but these other programs that provide these subsidies.
And what about the political influence of the industry? American Crystal Sugar Company donated more than $1.3 million to 221 members of Congress in the last election cycle, and that followed $1.4 million spent on lobbying in 2013. And then just here in Florida alone, the Tampa Bay Times has reported that U.S. Sugar and its executives have already made more than $500,000 in campaign donations to state candidates in their 2016 races.
I'm not
usually critical of the contributions. I will say the reason why they contribute, though, is because ultimately I blame Congress for it. Why do they do that? Because you've got this program that they want to keep in place. This program is so, it controls the market for them. So they're going to make sure that stays in place, and it tries to minimize, again, the risk they have, and it makes a lot of money for them. You know, it's just an idea of how powerful they are. We really are talking about a small industry. And if you look at the sugar-using industry, that's like the confectioners and other food manufacturers, there's so much bigger in comparison. Yet, it doesn't make a difference if some of those companies go overseas. The Congress doesn't seem to be caring about it. Consumers.
So confectioners are moving their production abroad because
some of them have.
Okay.
You know, some of them have. Look, the sugar costs generally have been much higher compared to world prices. It's been a bit lower recently, but as a kind of over the years, it's around 2 to 3 times higher than world prices. So some of the U.S. companies are deciding to move. And look, even government studies have shown that, you know, one study said that for every one job saved in the sugar-growing industry, nearly 3 confectioner manufacturing jobs were lost. I mean, that's significant. And a recent Iowa State University study showed that consumers could save over $3 billion by getting rid of the sugar program. So that's significant. So The sugar program is often called a no-cost program, but they, you know, but they say that because allegedly it doesn't cost taxpayers anything. But taxpayers also happen to be consumers, and when it comes to consumers, it costs us a lot of money.
Oh. And Frank, I think you wanted to say something back a minute ago when we were talking about those campaign contribution numbers.
I did. The bottom line is that whatever sugar wants, it gets. They throw so much money at candidates in both parties with a mission of controlling decisions by our state government, from the governor down, and exercising extraordinary influence over Congress. One of the political factors is that Florida is such an important state electorally. And so in presidential elections, sometimes Florida decides the outcome of the election, and the sugar growers have found a way to really use their money and use their influence to get favorable treatment from candidates on both sides and to get assurances and commitments that are tied into that presidential race. So we think that we've got to knock sugar down to size. If we're going to have a return to democracy in the state of Florida, we've got to knock down this very powerful corporate giant that is controlling state politics and is highly influencing federal politics as well. They have to be responsible citizens as well, and they are not right now.
Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the program, so we'll have to leave the conversation there. But thank you so much to all of my guests who've been here participating. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Frank Giacalone, Senior Regional Representative with the Sierra Club. Dr. Gail Hollander is a professor of geography at Florida International University and a speaker at the summit. Dr. Tom Lodge is a nationally recognized wetland ecologist, author, and consultant. David Guess is managing attorney for the Florida Office of Earth Justice, and Darren Baskst is a research fellow in agricultural policy with the Heritage Foundation's Institute for Economic Freedom and Opportunity. Both Darren and David will also be speaking at the summit. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we'll get an update from officials in Sarasota on their ongoing efforts to address the difficult and politically complex issues related to tackling chronic homelessness. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.